This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You're unlikely to see the words senile or Satan in a textbook. They are among dozens of words that are virtually banned by the school boards and bias and sensitivity committees, which advise the publishers of standardized tests and textbooks. These groups also exert control over the subject matter of textbooks. My guest, Diane Ravitch, says some of the censorship is trivial, some is ludicrous, and some is breathtaking in its power to dumb down what children learn in school. Ravitch is the author of the new book, The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Students Learn. She's a historian of education who teaches at New York University, and she's a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ravitch was assistant secretary in charge of research in the U.S. Department of Education in the administration of George H.W. Bush. She was appointed to the National Assessment Governing Board by President Clinton. I asked Diane Ravitch, who are the language police?
The language police is no longer people with names and faces. It really is just a process or a system that's been created to censor textbooks and tests. It's now a system that involves sanitizing words, topics from standardized tests, and also from which are used across the country, both national tests and state tests. And it's the self-censorship that publishers have imposed. And it really doesn't have to do with specific people anymore. It's about accepting as the industry standard that whatever is put before American school children, either in their textbooks or tests, has to be cleansed of certain words and language and topics.
Let's go over some of the words that are considered unacceptable and that need to be replaced, and some of the words that are totally banned. Okay, the word devil is in some places banned altogether. Why?
Right, because what this banning process of putting together words and topics that are banned comes from both people from the right and people from the left. And the whole process is a response to left-wing and right-wing censorship. Anything to do with the devil or fantasy or Satan or witchcraft or witches is offensive to very conservative groups. And so very conservative groups have imposed a ban on words like the devil or anything to do with witchcraft. That explains, for example, why the Harry Potter series today is not only the most popular series, it doesn't explain why it's the most popular series, it's the most banned books in the country because of the references to witchcraft, and also because Harry Potter has a dysfunctional family. And both of those are topics that the right wing hates.
So if the word devil is banned, does that mean that you also can't read books by, say, Nathaniel Hawthorne in high schools now?
Well, you know, the fact is a lot of teachers assign novels that are complete, and they assign novels that contain words that are on this list. Where this list has the most impact is on textbook publishing. And you may occasionally find a word that's on that list that appears in a textbook, but on the whole, and you know, for the most part, textbook publishers are watching for these words and watching for these topics and very, very carefully exclude them, because they know that if they go to a state like California or Texas with one of these words or topics included, they run the risk of first of all, setting off a huge controversy because groups will come and complain about them, and not having their textbook adopted at all, which would be a huge economic loss. So the better part of wisdom for textbook publishers and test publishers is to drop controversial words.
Now, the word extremist in some places can't be used because it has to be replaced with believer, follower, or adherent. Now, believer, follower, and adherent have a different meaning than extremist. Why can't you use the word extremist?
Well, amongst the different categories of words that are banned are words that are comparative in nature. So, for example, the word heretic is a banned word because that's an ethnocentric judgment. You know, one man's heretic is another man's adherent. Also, the word dogma is a banned word for the same reason, and the word cult is banned. So all of these are useful, valuable words, but they are considered ethnocentric. So and also words like culturally disadvantaged or economically disadvantaged are banned, and the word the expression backward or backward country as a relative term is banned. So all of these comparative judgments are considered ethnocentric, and those are all out.
Okay, let's look at some of the stereotyped images that need to be avoided in textbooks. There's a group of images of women that one should avoid. Women portrayed as mothers, teachers, nurses, or secretaries. What's the problem with that?
Well, these are have all been considered stereotype roles for women, and so they're out. And groups, feminist groups, complained very mightily and loudly in the 1980s and 1990s, and that's why there is a long list of female images or you know, things that are considered female occupations in the past that are not permitted anymore. So women are supposed to be portrayed as, you know, truck drivers and soldiers and doctors and leaders, but not as wives or nurses or secretaries or teachers.
So are there really a lot of textbooks where a woman can't be a mother in a story?
You know, there may be here and there a story with a woman portrayed as a mother, but that would not be her primary role. Mainly what you would see is complete gender equality, and where men and women, girls and boys, are all doing exactly the same thing.
Okay, African-American images to avoid include African-Americans in crowded tenements or chaotic streets, in big bright cars, in abandoned buildings with broken windows, or living in innocuous, dull, white picket fence neighborhoods. Your comment?
Well, it's very hard to know how someone who's illustrating a textbook can fairly and honestly portray any ethnic group unless they just show them as being without any characteristics. I mean, as you look through the different kinds of images to avoid the so-called stereotypes, it's anything that would be culturally specific that would make one appear to be African-American or Asian-American or Hispanic-American, anything that would be actually highlight differences. So the odd thing about this is that so many of these bans are intended to promote diversity when, in fact, they promote homogeneity because everyone ends up looking the same but with a slightly different skin hue.
So for Asian-Americans, it's considered a stereotype if you represent an Asian-American as very intelligent, an excellent scholar, ambitious, hardworking, or competitive.
This is considered a stereotype. It's called the model minority myth, and this is offensive to someone, so that's one of the ways that you're not supposed to portray Asian Americans.
Okay, older Americans, images to avoid include older Americans in nursing homes or with canes, walkers, wheelchairs, orthopedic shoes, or eyeglasses. Is it not a fact of life that at some point, and people are living into their 80s and 90s, now that at some point you need help walking, or you certainly need eyeglasses.
Well, I think that the stereotyped images of older Americans is one that I find the most amusing because I am now, I think, an older American. I'm 64, and there are days when I feel weak and dependent and sickly, but I can't be portrayed looking that way. So I think this whole thing is very amusing because I believe the intention is that you're only supposed to portray men and women, let's say in their 70s or 80s, snowboarding and climbing up on the roof to repair the roof or jogging or running a marathon. It's really ridiculous because what these kinds of images suggest, what the avoidance of these images suggest, is that you can't describe reality.
Now, how many states would you say have to follow the majority of the guidelines that you've just discussed in terms of language and stereotypical images? Are we talking about 3-4 states? Are we talking about 40 states?
My description of censorship in the testing industry and the textbook industry does not affect 3 or 4 states. It describes what's happening in every part of the United States because it affects the 4 mega corporations that dominate educational publishing. It also affects every major testing company. Every major testing company uses what's called bias and sensitivity review to make sure there are no offensive or insensitive words or topics. And the process that I've described as language policing is omnipresent throughout educational publishing, throughout the textbook industry, and throughout the testing industry. There is no state that escapes this. There may be individual classrooms that escape it because their teachers are using let's say, real novels that have not been sanitized or bowdlerized, and they may be making up their own tests, which would consist of, let's say, essays about what they've read. But if they're using standardized tests and if they're using mass-produced textbooks, then what the students encounter has been sanitized and, to some extent, bowdlerized by the language police.
You first came across bias and sensitivity review panels when you were working on a standardized test. You had work to come up with readings and to approve them, and then you found out what?
Well, I was appointed to something called the National Assessment Governing Board. It's a federal agency that administers national tests, and I was appointed during the Clinton administration by President Clinton, and President Clinton had decided in 1997 that he thought there should be a voluntary national test that included a fourth grade reading test. And so the first thing that I did as a member of that organization, and a federal organization, was to read fourth grade passages that might appear on this voluntary national test. And as a member of a fairly sizable committee of people reading passages, we approved, dozens of passages that would be appropriate for fourth grade children. And about 18 months later, about 15 or 20 of these passages were returned to us, and we were told that they were biased or insensitive and should be deleted. And I was shocked, because some of them were just, all of them were completely innocuous passages, and I didn't see any bias in them. And just to give you some examples, one of them was a short biography of the man who designed Mount Rushmore, Gutzon Borglum. And it seemed appropriate for fourth graders. Almost everyone is familiar with that image of the four massive presidential heads. But the bias reviewers said that we could not have that question because Mount Rushmore was built on the land that was sacred to the Lakota Indians, and therefore this whole passage should be deleted, and they recommended that it be eliminated. Another passage was about a woman named Mary McLeod Bethune, who was an African-American woman, a leader. She created a school for girls in Daytona, Florida in the early 20th century. And we thought it was a great passage, a wonderful hero story. And they said it should be deleted, first of all, because the school was called the Daytona Industrial and Training School for Negro Girls. And they said that the word Negro should not appear in a standardized test, even though that actually was the name of her school. And secondly, because her son Albert attended, and they said if that was mentioned, then kids would know that she was separated from her husband. And we could not have separation as a topic or acknowledging that people, women and men, separated in their marriages. A third passage that I thought was an excellent passage was a true story about a 25-year-old man who was blind, who was the first blind man to climb Mount McKinley, and he did this in an ice storm. And it was an inspiring story. And they said this should be eliminated, first of all, because the story contained regional bias. It happened in an ice storm, and kids who had never seen an ice storm wouldn't be able to understand the story. So that was regional bias. And then they said it should be eliminated because it was biased against blind people. And since it was a heroic story, I couldn't understand why that was biased. But then they said, well, it's biased against blind people because it suggests that it's heroic for him to have climbed Mount McKinley as a blind person, and blindness should not be treated as a handicap. Well, I thought all of this was bizarre, and then I went back and realized that the test publisher, had actually given us a set of guidelines, and I had looked at them thinking how odd they were, and I went back and reviewed them and discovered that we had about 25 or 30 pages describing all of these topics, regional bias and, that you couldn't treat blindness as a handicap. All of that was laid out. And I became fascinated with the idea of where this notion of bias came from, that so many commonplace ideas should suddenly be construed as bias. And I began gathering bias guidelines from many different publishers of textbooks and tests, and that was the genesis of this book.
One of the textbook publishers that you got guidelines from is called Riverside Publishing. What do they publish?
Riverside was the test publisher for the voluntary national test. They also published the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, and they were the first to show me these guidelines. Now, I don't think they're publicly available. We only got a copy of them because we were members of a federal agency overseeing the development of the voluntary national test. But this is a very important mainstream test publisher. And what I've learned since I've contacted many other test publishers is that the Riverside guidelines are very similar to the guidelines of ETS, National Evaluation System, American Institutes of Research, and virtually all the state testing agencies. And that's how I came to understand that the scrutinizing of tests for anything that might offend anybody anywhere is considered the industry standard.
Now, the guidelines of Riverside Publishing say that you cannot refer to evolution, but you also can't refer to fossils or dinosaurs because they suggest evolution?
Well, that's correct. You can't refer to anything that might imply evolution. You also can't refer to Halloween because Halloween suggests witchcraft, and witchcraft is another one of those banned topics because it offends right-wing parents.
But you also can't discuss social problems like poverty, alcoholism, and divorce.
Correct. Those are out because they upset somebody. I'm not sure whether it's the right wing or the left wing, but however you discuss raise those problems, it's going to be offensive to someone.
Slavery and racial prejudice are taboo?
Right. Those are offensive to, again, you can't always say who it will offend, but they know from past experience that they will get letters from one or more people saying, I don't like that question, I don't like that topic. And so the simplest thing to avoid controversy is just to delete it.
Catastrophes like earthquakes and fires are to be avoided. That's not a politically correct issue, is it?
That's considered a topic. Earthquakes, fires, or let's say references to creepy animals or to rats and mice, those would be upsetting to sensitive children. And the claim is that if children encounter something on a test that upsets them, they won't be able to do their best. And so you must take care to avoid, let's say cancer, someone losing their job, you know, unemployment. All of these are earthquakes, fires. This is all very upsetting to someone somewhere, so therefore it should not be mentioned.
Now, you say that the method in which textbooks are purchased has a lot to do with the kind of patrolling of language that we're seeing now. What is the system of purchasing textbooks that has influenced the content of textbooks?
Today there are 22 states that in which the State Board of Education selects the textbooks that are to be used throughout the state. Now, some teachers can buy other books, but their district has to put the money up. The state won't pay for it. So it becomes a very powerful tool with which the State Board of Education can make these purchases and influence what's taught in the schools. The problem comes about because there are two states in particular, California and Texas, have a huge amount of power. They have such large enrollments. And if a publisher can't get their textbook sold in these two states, the chances are they're not going to make it as a publisher. They may even go out of business, or they won't even attempt to get a national adoption at all. So these two states wield huge power, and because they're like a choke for the textbook process, pressure groups can come before the Texas State Board of Education and the California State Board of Education and wield enormous power way out of any relationship to their size. So what's happened is that this narrowing of the marketplace to conform to the needs of Texas and California has, first of all, caused tremendous concentration in the publishing industry. There are today only four big corporations that publish textbooks. They're not the only ones, but they dominate about 75% to 80% of the textbook market. The only one of these that is American-owned at the moment is McGraw-Hill. The others are Reed Elsevier, which is Dutch, Pearson, which is British, and Vivendi, which is French. And Vivendi has been in the process of selling off Houghton Mifflin, so it will hopefully soon be, again, an American-owned textbook company. But there are basically right now only four big companies publishing for the most of the market. Because of the way state textbook adoption has narrowed competition, it's made it so expensive to get into the business at all. So what has happened over the past 15 or 20 years is that the publishers have accepted the responsibility for self-censorship. The groups that I've described in my book no longer need to go before the State Board of Education and harass them about textbooks because they have successfully gotten the publishers to self-censor.
So when Texas and California were more active with their own bias and sensitivity reviews, were their concerns similar or were their concerns different?
Well, California was considered the liberal state and Texas the conservative state. And so the California social content guidelines, which are still in effect, required publishers to have a very careful gender balance, but then so did Texas require gender balance, and NOW went before the state boards in both states to demand gender balance, to the extent where Open Court, which is one of the books that where I was able to get the internal correspondence because it changed hands, and so the the publisher who no longer owns the company gave me the internal correspondence. Open Court had, in its book, had to change the little engine that could into a female engine as a way of increasing the representation of females. There were other books where the textbook publisher had to literally change the gender of a character. And in one case that I found, the author went along with the idea of changing Freddie to Maggie in order to increase the representation of women.
You try to trace the beginnings of this move toward politically correct, sanitized language in textbooks and standardized tests. And you date it to the late 60s, early 70s, and the civil rights movement of that period. What were the original intentions and what were the original issues?
Well, the original issues were valid. There was a complete absence of stories about American blacks. There was a tremendous imbalance in terms of how girls were portrayed. Girls were always the helper. They were never the active participant in anything. And girls were, well, it was the kind of Dick and Sally routine where Dick and Jane textbooks was always the one who was actively doing things, and Sally or Jane were holding his coat for him or urging him on. So I think there was quite a valid concern about the role of women was changing, and the representation of girls should reflect that.
Where do you feel that movement that you think of as being very justified went off track?
I would say that the movement went off track when it veered into censorship. I found that, for instance, with an organization that was quite instrumental in the events in the language police, the Council on Interracial Books for Children. It began as an advocacy group that said there should be more and better stories about the life of minorities, of blacks and of Hispanics, and also of women in textbooks. And it went from adding to what children read and improving the quality of what they read to issuing censorship lists, saying, we don't like what's in this book, it shouldn't be read. These stories should be stigmatized. They even suggested to the American Library Association that certain books, which did not have the correct representation or portrayal of these groups, should be removed from the library shelves or should be labeled in such a way that would stigmatize them. That became a censorship campaign. And, you know, quite frankly, the National Organization for Women did some of the same thing. When you urge people not to read books, when you stigmatize books because you don't like the portrayals in them, then that's censorship. It goes beyond trying to say, here's something I think is better, I hope you'll read it, to don't read Mary Poppins. The Council for Interracial Books for Children actually urged that fairy tales be eliminated. And there was a long list of classic works, including Mary Poppins and the Roald Dahl books, that they considered to be inappropriate. And, of course, a series of books that was banned at the urging of the Council for Interracial Books for Children was the Hugh Lofting Dr. Doolittle books. And I tried to find the original copies, the original language of the Dr. Doolittle books, and it's virtually impossible. I couldn't find it in the library. I couldn't find it on the Internet. And only the books, the rewritten version, is available. Then I discovered the New York Public Library has them in a special collection, apparently because it has portrayals of Africans that are unacceptable.
Now, you reviewed a dozen world history textbooks while writing your new book. What are some of the things that you found could not be discussed or could not be discussed in a clear way?
Well, what I got for the most part from reading the world history books was a huge sense of boredom. It's just an unbelievable mass of material that has no thematic connection. What's missing, and I think in part because of these bias guidelines, is any effort to compare cultures or civilizations. You're not allowed to say that one is more or less advanced than another. That's out. And so when there's a discussion of the Mayans and the Aztecs, they're presented as a glorious civilization, which I'm sure that they were, but without the downside, which is that they practiced human sacrifice and that it was a pretty terrible time to be alive. Also, only one of the books that I reviewed mentions the fact that that they had not yet discovered the wheel, which was kind of an important technological discovery. But there's an effort on the part of the publishers and the authors to present every civilization as glorious, and so because this represents a kind of sanitizing of history and a kind of prettifying of it that takes away from reality, which is that a civilization can be quite glorious in its art and even in its architecture and be quite brutal at the same time. And you're not telling the whole story if you only tell the pretty parts.
You say that it's very difficult to discuss religion now in history texts. What are the problems?
Well, all religions have to be presented in a positive light. And I looked at this in terms of how was Islam presented? And, you know, Islam is a great religion. There's no question that the Islamic civilization in the Middle Ages was the greatest civilization at that time. But when the textbooks deal with modern-day Islam, they become tongue-tied. They have a hard time discussing the role of women in Islam, for example. And they talk only about how women's rights have expanded under Islam. One of the textbooks has a photograph of a group of women, head-to-toe burqas, going on a boating expedition. I think it's a problem that American kids have to talk about, with quite honestly, about the question of the role of women in Islam. The reason the textbooks have such a hard time discussing Islam, or any other religion for that matter, is that all of them, almost all of them, there's one exception, has a multicultural advisory board. Three of the major publishers have exactly the same advisor on the Islamic religion, and so they all echo each other with a very positive picture of the role of women in Islam, and not mentioning, for example, that what we would consider somewhat brutal treatment of minor crimes, like having your hands cut off or being beheaded. You know, maybe this is or is not brutal, but at least it should be discussed. It isn't even discussed because everything has been reviewed by the same Islamic advocacy group, a small group out in California. And three of the four publishers submit their materials for this person's approval.
After researching this long critique of American textbooks, what are your conclusions about what the larger problem is? You know, if the textbooks have been vetted and in many cases censored, what's the larger educational problem this is creating?
I think it's important for children in school, young people in school, to read exciting narratives, and they're not going to find that in a textbook. Now, a textbook may be a perfectly useful reference work, and I did find a few that I liked. In world history, there was one that called World History, Continuity and Change. And the U.S. histories, there some were better than others, and I described those. But the overall problem with textbooks is that there's a narrative that says, we know the answers to these questions. They've all been settled, and here's fact. And that's deadly. That's deadly. What kids need to learn in school is, no, we don't know the answers. We're still struggling to figure things out. Historians are arguing that at the time things happened, nobody knew how things would turn out. I mean, when you watch something on TV and it's a terrific documentary and get a sense of the times, it's so exciting. And the textbook kills that. The textbook kills the sense of not knowing the answer and how uncertain people were at the time of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, these guys put their life on the line. They could have all been strung up and killed by the British for signing that document. But it's never presented as contingent, as controversial, but as a settled fact. And I think there's an overall problem of boredom that results from all of these settled facts being strung together.
Now, I went to public schools in the 1960s before the language police era, and I can tell you that the textbooks that I read were dull, and they weren't controversial. They didn't examine issues or the past in an interesting way. So, I mean, has anything fundamentally changed?
I think that some things...
In other words, have the textbooks ever been good? Have they ever been interesting?
I think that you'd have to go back to the earlier part of the 20th century to find textbooks that were engaging. And the reason they were engaging was that they were written by one person. And when you have one person writing the book and taking responsibility for the words in it, then there is there's a better chance you're going to have a voice. I mean, the biggest problem with textbooks, and it would have been true of the textbooks of the, whether it was the 60s or the 50s or now, is the lack of voice. And the lack of voice creates this kind of omniscient, you are reading an encyclopedia, you are reading fact, and you are being bored out of your skull. That's a problem. And so I think about textbooks I've written that were, or textbooks that I've read that were written many years ago. And I think about David Saville Muzzy's textbooks, which were lively and engaging. And there were others, you know, Charles Beard wrote textbooks. There were other wonderful historians, but they took responsibility for their language, and they weren't going to put out something that had been generated by committee. And today the textbooks, some of them have authors' names on them where the authors are dead. And, you know, who knows who writes them? They go through a process of almost like a meat grinder, and what comes out is this kind of plodding prose.
What do you think it would take to change the course of history and literature textbooks and to undo the work of what you describe as the literary police, the language police?
To remove the language police from our schools would mean removing them both from textbook publishing and from testing. And I think the first thing that has to happen is to end state textbook adoptions. I think this is the beginning of the corruption of this whole process of buying books for schools, is giving the states the power to say, to anoint one textbook and to reject everything else. I think that the decisions about what books to be used in the classroom should primarily be made by individual teachers. And this would right away encourage a real marketplace instead of having a massive concentration of textbook publishers. There would be the possibility of small publishers selling to classrooms and to teachers because their product is better. So that would have, I think, a beneficent impact. It would take time because this current system is so deeply ingrained that it would take time to, in effect, revive a marketplace for real publishers to sell things to the classroom. Secondly, I think in terms of test publishing, there should be much more openness and transparency than there is today. Today, there is virtually no transparency. I wrote to one state education department. I wrote to many state education departments and asked them for examples of works or passages that had been censored for their state test, and got some responses. But in one case, a state education department wrote me and said, we don't have to tell that to you. Now, this is a public agency, and they're censoring literary materials, and their view is they don't have to explain that to anyone. I believe they should, as a matter of law, be required to put on a website what kinds of materials they're using for their state test. We would find out whether they're using good literature or junk, and they should also show what they've excerpted, what have they sanitized, what have they censored, what have they bowdlerized. So that would be a huge step forward, is just to open up censorship of the testing process. Also put on their website what their bias guidelines are. Then people like me wouldn't have to dig so hard to find out what's actually being censored. It's going on everywhere, and we just don't even know what it is. So that, to me, is the great scandal, is that most of this censorship is taking place behind closed doors. It's considered a good thing to do, and it has to be brought out into the open.
Well, Diane Ravitch, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Diane Ravitch is the author of The Language Police, How Pressure Groups Restrict What Children Learn. She's a professor of education at NYU.